You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Caden toku ingoa. Nō mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for our Pare Thursday. My name is Caden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Pranusha. Efa Akane coming up on the show. For City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about a law change that will mean only elected councillors can vote on council committees and what Budget 2026 means for Auckland. And I spoke to both Professor Te Kaka Keegan from the University of Waikato and Professor Nirmal Nair from the University of Auckland about a new UN University report on the environmental impacts of AI. And Tuesday Wire host Alex spoke with Elliot Crossan, the co-chair of Auckland Action Against Poverty, about the changes made to social housing in the 2026 budget. Pranusha, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about the 2026 budget, and I also spoke with senior lecturer Dr. Lisa Darragh, challenging the idea that New Zealand is facing a maths education crisis.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai. Text in on 5395 or Waia Mairane. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka awe wareware I ahiana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. He pakehiri rukiruki mārunga i te pai. Tuku tuku o irirangi pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Budget 2026 has been met with mixed reactions, with the government highlighting major investments in healthcare and defence, while also confirming the end of the fees-free tertiary education scheme. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about healthcare funding, the scrapping of fees-free, and the government's decision to significantly increase defence spending.
It's now been a week since budget has been released. What's Labour's overall assessment of the budget?
Well, we know that funding that's been allocated isn't enough to keep up with what's needed. Christopher Luxon, he promised to fix the economy and to provide respite on the cost of living. And this budget was the last chance for him to do that. And there wasn't anything in there for the average New Zealander needing a bit of help at the moment.
The government has highlighted health as one of the biggest winners in the budget, with more than $5.8 billion in new operating funding and significant investment in hospital infrastructure. Does Labour welcome that funding?
Yeah, it's very clear that New Zealanders need better health care and there is more investment required. I guess the question for the government and for Simeon Brown is, where is that spend going to? We've seen recently that we've seen increase to the fees being paid to Paula Bennett, for example, as the director of Pharmac. You know, that's not necessarily a decision that New Zealanders want to see at the moment. They want to see investment going into the front line. And what they're saying at the moment, of course, is that it's becoming more expensive, more unaffordable to go to the local doctor. So those are the sorts of solutions that people want to see. And that's why Labour's put up our policy for 3 free GP visits universally per year.
And how concerned is Labour about staffing shortages and workforce retention in health?
I've been following this closely, particularly on the North Shore, where there was somewhat of a funding staffing freeze. It's important that we're investing in our frontline and that positions like healthcare assistants, like nurses and doctors, you know, are taken care of, that they're well resourced in order to do the job that we need them to do.
And do you think New Zealanders will notice a difference in their day-to-day experiences with the health system because of this budget?
Well, what we're seeing is by funding the health system less than what is needed, then it impacts on the frontline services that we all rely on. So New Zealanders should be concerned at the moment and they should be looking at the government and Christopher Luxon and asking the question, am I better off? And I think the simple answer that most New Zealanders will come to is no.
And just moving on to fees-free, we talked a little bit about it a couple weeks ago, but what kind of message does scrapping fees-free send to the current and prospective tertiary students?
Well, the message that's been sent is that students aren't a priority, that this government isn't willing to invest in their future. What we've seen is $1.1 billion that was allocated to fees-free be somewhat reallocated elsewhere by very small amounts. We're looking for almost $1 billion that has disappeared as a result. Winston Peters and Christopher Luxon promised that that money would be reallocated to vocational training. That's not what has happened under this budget. So that's a real loss to students. It's a real loss to the investment for our future workforces, but it's a real loss to tertiary education as a whole.
And at the same time, students are facing fee increases and a difficult job market. How significant do you think these pressures are for young New Zealanders?
Students have been really clear with me that they need support both now and in the future. And so to lose fees free, as well as see another increase of 6% on their fees, that's not the direction that students are wanting to go in, that they're asking for support from a government. And instead, they've received an 18% increase in their student fees over the last 3 years under Christopher Luxon. What we've also seen is not just university students, but that also impacts apprenticeships, work-based learning, students studying at Wānanga and polytechs. They're all affected by this decision, and they all miss out in the thousands of dollars that they were promised under Christopher Luxon.
And just lastly, talking about defence spending, one of the biggest new spending commitments in the budget was defence, around $1.6 billion in new funding and a commitment to eventually lift defence spending to 2% of GDP. Does Labor support that direction?
We support increasing defence spending to navigate what is a very volatile global environment at the moment, but the cuts to defence staff make no sense whatsoever, that we invest in one part, but we don't invest in the people that are actually doing the jobs that we need to. So, you know, that's pretty concerning for us, that's concerning for New Zealanders, but overall we're in support of increasing the defence budget. I think it's been a long time coming, but that shouldn't come at the cost of people and other priorities and political choices that this government seems to be making.
Do you think New Zealanders are being brought into that conversation about what trade-offs might be required?
Yeah, absolutely. And the government has chosen to position it this way. For example, in the fees-free conversation, is that they pitted university students against other students in the system. They've pitted defence money against other areas of spending. They pitted pay equity against landlords. And so this is the contrast and the theme of this government, that they continue to run a position that is about winners and losers. If you don't vote for them, you're a loser. If you are a landlord or tobacco companies, you're a winner.
If the government says that money is tight around this budget, how is it possible to find billions for defence while scrapping fees-free and cutting thousands of public sector jobs?
Well, it's about political choices, and New Zealanders have been really clear that their priorities are about jobs, getting good employment. It's about good quality health care for their families. It's about making sure that everyone can live in warm, dry houses. And that most of all, that the government delivers on the promise that they made around the cost of living. None of those things seem to be the priority for this government. And what we're seeing instead is them looking after their mates, investing in the things that aren't necessarily priorities for New Zealanders. And that's the political choices that they make. And that's the decisions that New Zealanders need to hold them accountable to come the 7th of November.
That was Shannon Halbert about healthcare funding, the scrapping of fees-free, and the increase to defence spending.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father. City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
The government is changing the law so only elected councillors can vote on council committees, stopping iwi representatives and independent experts from being full voting members. And last week, the government announced the budget for the next year. It includes investment in areas like housing, health and rail infrastructure for Auckland. For City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about both of these topics. I started by asking what he thought about the government changing the law so that only elected members can vote on council committees.
Yeah, certainly came by surprise. It sort of just dropped in a press release while we're in a council meeting, actually. So we didn't have much of a heads up of that, and we still kind of need advice on how it affects Auckland specifically. But look, I'm frustrated. That was my first thought. I mean, any sort of suggestion that iwi representatives or anything like that, never mind audit and risk committees where we have independent members of them handling sort of the audit and obviously the audit and risk function of councils. There's several things that we are doing and could be doing in terms of members of committees, and so to be told from on high from the government doesn't sort of align with the principles of localism and local democracy and people deciding their own arrangements by their community. So that was kind of my top line thoughts, but you know, we haven't been advised on it. It's sort of taken us by surprise, yeah.
The government says having non-elected members with voting power is essentially undemocratic. What is your response to this?
Well, I mean, there's several situations where you actually do want them to have the same power of everyone else on a committee. We're talking about sort of Treaty of Waitangi obligations and the arrangements that people have up and down the country around those things. And the other obvious example I pointed out is audit and risk committees, where we have we have accountants looking over council's books and making sure that things are all tickety-boo. We wouldn't be able to function if those people were not able to vote on things. So, yeah, there's a couple of really serious situations there where, you know, I'm not quite sure what problem the government is trying to solve with those situations. So, yeah, like I said, it's all a little bit up in the air and a little bit frustrating that we're being sort of dictated to in this way when, you know, local democracy should be winning out on these kind of things.
As you've kind of alluded to, local councils, including in Hastings, have raised concerns that they will lose the expert advice that comes with having external members around the council table. In the past, how has Auckland Council balanced a need for expertise with democratic obligations?
Yeah, well, we can assure the public that democracy does is sort of the primary concern, and we have, you know, the governing body committee is all elected members, for example, and that's the top one. Every other committee reports to that committee. But having said that, you know, we have utilised expertise, and, you know, I've talked a little bit about the audit and risk stuff as well. But just to go further in terms of our IMSB arrangements we have here, we have other committees such as the Waitakere Rangers Heritage Forum that I'm on, where we seek expert views from mana whenua on management of natural resources and sort of get their advice and their input. That's really important, and it helps us make better decisions. And, you know, ultimately, isn't the goal of local councils to make the best decisions with people's ratepayers' dollar and with their resources in the city? That should be our primary concern. And so I'm not quite sure what problem is trying to be solved with this very surprising press release and now dictation, yeah.
And I want to turn now to ask about the central government's budget 2026. From your perspective, was there anything in that budget for Auckland?
Yeah, there's some real upsides there, which, you know, it's good to be talking about things on a positive note here. So there was some budget put aside for rail maintenance, which I think is really good because there's been decades of a lack of maintenance, and that's caused us to have some real issues as we're trying to get a CRL open. We've had to have a big track upgrade situation to kind of fix those historic problems. So it's good that was in there. I see we've got some growth funding in there. It says a financial incentive for councils to encourage housing growth. It's kind of sad that we're at that situation. I think we should be encouraging it without, you know, having to be directed in that way. But, you know, very happy for that funding. You know, there's some moves for hospital planning in South Auckland. That's really good. So, yeah, there's some good stuff there. I think the next frontier for us, from my perspective, is rail crossings. That's a huge issue for Auckland and something that we're going to need more funding for. So I'm hoping that in future budgets we'll be looking at that a little bit closer.
It's great. There's so many positives in the budget, but as you started speaking to at the end there, what areas would you like to see further government investment in? Or is there any specific funding that was missing from this budget that you'd like to see in future budgets?
Yeah, there's two things that came to mind immediately. So firstly, the rail crossing situation, where we've got, you know, multi-billion-dollar price tag and fixing the rail crossings across Auckland to really capitalise on that CRL investment. So that's something we need to be keeping on investing, and that's hoping, I'm hoping that in future budgets we'll be looking at that. The other thing is the bed night levy. So cities across the world allow their tourists, essentially, to pay for major events in their city through a small uptick on their sort of hotel prices. It's a fair system. It's a system that works great and as I said, many other countries and cities across the world. And for some reason, the government doesn't like it. Auckland has been lobbying for years on this, and I know the mayor is particularly strong on this point. You know, it just makes sense. And so it's frustrating that we're scrambling to try and fund major events and looking at kind of government pots and things like that, whereas actually we could be doing things a lot smarter, and Auckland Council have long advocated for it, so I'm really hoping the government changes their mind.
And how does Budget 2026 align with Council's budget that also passed last week?
Yeah, so a pretty difficult budget discussion last week at Council, and yeah, some real, I suppose, controversy and challenges there. So, you know, the long and short of it is we've essentially passed a 0% rates increase with a rail link attached, and something the mayor has been, you know, putting out there quite a bit. The challenge is, you know, we're trying to keep public services running and to the level that people expect. And there is a price tag to that. And so that is the challenge that we've been facing. And in future years, that will continue to be a challenge. So how we fund local government, I mean, we should always be thinking about those questions. And I'd encourage the government to put some thinking on it too, because we're willing partners in this kind of stuff. We just got to get around the table.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on a law change that will mean only elected councillors can vote on council committees and what Budget 2026 means for Auckland.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts on any of these pieces, 5395.
A palooza for the ages is upon us. It's Prozapalooza, a one-day music extravaganza with a red-hot lineup of bands. And 95BFM have our hands on some double passes to give to lucky B-card holders. Tune in to drive all week for your cue to enter. Prozapalooza, double whammy and public bar. Sunday, June 7th, doors at 1 p.m. Get your tickets now from under the radar.
The Hard, Fast and Heavy Show.
Oh, beloved woman of liberty!
2 hours of punk, hardcore, goats, doom, metal and thrash.
Just the apocalypse on earth to keep me alive!
The Hard, Fast and Heavy Show.
A man reduced for singularistic survive!
11 p.m. to 1 a.m. every Sunday night, only on 95BFM.
You ready to play?
Yeah. I've just got to piss real quick. All right. Showtime. 95BFM Drive Live. Trillions of listeners will hear me. I'll finally make Mum proud if she listens. Maybe Freddie will listen and finally think I'm hot and cool and lovable. Oh, come on.
Hurry up.
Okay, this is it. Time to shine. Crap. No toilet paper.
Tune in every Friday live. Music beaming in direct from 95BFM Drive. Friday Live on 95BFM. Thanks to New Zealand On Air.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
The government has been presenting maths education as a crisis that needs urgent fixing, with Education Minister Erica Stanford pushing through rapid reforms. But some education experts say that the picture is much more complicated than the public narrative suggests, and that the real issues are being oversimplified. I spoke with Dr. Lisa Darragh from the University of Auckland about what the evidence actually shows, why the crisis framing has taken hold, and what the current reforms could mean for students and teachers.
Now, to start broadly, you've argued that evidence doesn't clearly show New Zealand's math education system in a crisis. Why do you think that narrative has become so dominant?
Yeah, well, I see that having a crisis narrative can be really useful for enacting change politically. You know, by saying, hey, everything's in crisis, then politicians can kind of justify some of the reform process that they're taking. But what's quite problematic about this is that the pace of the reform becomes far too quick. So by saying, oh, everything's in crisis, everything's urgent, it means that reforms can go through without adequate consultation and without adequate consideration. And that's what we're seeing in the case of mathematics education, and I would probably say education more broadly as well. And the second problem with it is that it kind of means that there can be shortcuts made, and sometimes the shortcuts, skip due process. So normally what happens with educational changes, there's, certain steps that are taken, like whenever there's a procurement of resources, for example, there's a process that gets gone through. What we've seen with some of this with fast-paced action is that due process hasn't been followed. So the third curriculum that was written in maths education had none of the usual processes of saying who would like to write it, and instead it just got kind of, we don't actually know who wrote it. It seems to have been sort of outsourced to a company without any kind of potential for people to bid for that. We see things like last-minute changes to the Education Act saying, oh, we need to remove teachers from the Teachers Council. And so that all of these things that happen really quickly aren't good for education. They might be good for politics, but they're not good for the teaching and the learning of the students in our country, because it hasn't been slow enough and considered enough.
And you noted in your article that New Zealand's PISA scores have fallen, but that similar declines were seen across much of OECD during COVID and after COVID. How important is that context?
I mean, it's extremely important. And the thing about these sorts of big international data sets is that you can read them in different ways, right? You can look at absolute scores, you can look at comparative rankings, you can pick various time points where you're going to compare between now and then. And so you can actually get kind of creative with the statistics. So you can sort of say, okay, let's find the right data that's going to help me tell a story. And things are going on in other countries as well. So making the comparisons to other countries isn't always a good thing. We, historically in New Zealand, we've had less emphasis on kind of sit-down testing. We've had sort of more authentic assessment activities. And so we might not do as well as other countries that do a whole lot of sit-down testing. And it's important to remember that testing is not learning. Any time that is taken out for testing is time that's not spent learning new things. So I think it's really important to look at the big picture, look at the data across all of the years, look at all of the data points, and to also look at our national data. And we have some really rigorous assessments nationally that show that students have been achieving the same year after year after year. Now, this is a great thing in maths education. We actually want to affect change. We want improvements. We want to see our students doing better in maths. We want, we want to fix the issue that we have with so many kids not being very good at fractions. We want to make these improvements. We, in general, have had kind of an underinvestment in education of late. I'm not sort of blaming any political party for this. I would say two terms of Labor didn't invest enough in education, and three terms of National before that didn't invest enough in education as well. So we've had a real stagnation in mathematics education, but we don't see crisis when we look at that national data.
Now, Education Minister Erica Stanford has introduced a new curriculum, standardized assessments, and structured maths approaches. What concerns do teachers and maths education experts have about these reforms?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because depending on the subject area, there's a slightly different story. So we're, and I think that can be quite confusing for the public. What we've had in both maths and English is Labor introduced new curriculum across the subject areas. National came in and rewrote those curriculum. And what we had is maths and English got new curriculums in, and they required to implement them at the beginning of 2025. Where all the other subject areas were still in draft form, maths and English had to follow this new curriculum. And the thing that got the whole sector up in arms is that 10 months after the introduction of this curriculum, a new one out of the blue landed in everyone's lap. So we had a third maths curriculum arriving. So despite the fact that teachers had been given a new curriculum, they were learning it, they were implementing it as they went along, which is always challenging to be learning the curriculum and teaching it at the same time. Normally you actually get sort of lead-in time and you get time to learn a curriculum before you actually have to implement it on the run. But they were doing this, they were doing it in good faith, they were taking on board the changes in the curriculum and the increased difficulty level, they were appreciating some aspects of the curriculum, such as more detailed and specific information about what to teach at each level. And then suddenly this other curriculum arrived and it doesn't appear to have an author. It doesn't relate well to our own context. It just arrived out of the blue, and that was kind of upsetting for teachers to see that happen, especially since this curriculum is overloaded. In mathematics, it's overloaded with stuff that the students will have to memorise and do. It's a whole focus on memorising in this particular curriculum. You asked about structured maths, saying that the minister's introduced structured maths. Now, the thing is, structured literacy is something that has a lot of research behind it, and you know, there's a lot of people who are very fond of structured literacy approaches. It's not the only way to teach literacy, but there's a reasonable uptake in the sector. But there actually isn't structured maths, so to speak. So there's plenty of plenty of the international groups or resources say, oh, yes, we do structured maths. And in response to the minister asking for resources that teach structured maths, but it isn't actually a thing. So what I think is meant when people say structured maths is they're kind of talking about a focus on explicit teaching and making sure that teaching is done in a sort of explicit sense that's quite teacher-centred and a little bit less student-centred than other pedagogies.
And you described a pattern before where the government establishes a sense of crisis, repeats this message, and then offers the reform solution. How do you see that playing out currently in the maths reform?
That's a good question. So what I think will actually happen is we're going to see a dip in performance. The latest results that we've had were measuring against the 2023 version of the curriculum, and this is a version that was never actually taught. The version of the curriculum that is out at the moment, and I call it the 2025 version, is much more difficult than that. And so the percentage of our students able to achieve the expectations of this more difficult curriculum is much lower than the data even shows. We don't know how much lower, but it will be lower because it's more difficult. And we're going to end up having a whole lot of students completely put off mathematics because the level is too much more difficult too quickly. And we've got a whole lot of the secondary school content has been pushed down into intermediate school. And at intermediate school, our teachers are not necessarily specialists in teaching mathematics. So there's some really sophisticated concepts that have to be taught that, in my opinion, should be taught by maths specialists, but are instead of being kind of forced on the generalist teachers of primary school, and I don't think it's going to play out well. We're going to see these students going to secondary school really unprepared for the level that the secondary schools are being required to teach, because that's higher as well for universities being moved down into year 9 and 10. And so we're going to see a dip in student achievement and motivation and joy in the subject of mathematics. And if it carries out in the long term, and if it follows how things are going in other countries that have taken on this really explicit, rigid approach to teaching of mathematics, we're going to see the drop-offs in participation in higher-level mathematics and drop-offs in participation in all of those subjects that require a high level of mathematics, which is in all the kind of careers that you might go into that require mathematics. Yeah, I think the final message I'd like to say is that we really need to listen to the teachers who are experiencing this reform and not just assume that they are reacting to change, because the teachers are willing to take change on board. I'm sure that teachers were happy to make changes in mathematics, but the pace and direction of this reform is not going to be conducive to good long-term educational outcomes.
That was Senior Lecturer Dr. Lisa Darrick on the maths education crisis.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Last week's budget saw the government raise rents in social housing alongside other changes to the way the welfare system operates in New Zealand. This has received criticism from those who are concerned for the well-being of those in poverty and in social housing. Tuesday Wire host Alex spoke with co-chair of Auckland Action Against Poverty, Elliot Crossan, about these budget changes and how it will impact both those living in and on the brink of social housing.
Just to get us started, when we take stock of the current situation in Aotearoa and Auckland with both social housing and poverty, what are we seeing? What is it like at the moment?
It's pretty rough for a lot of people. We've got record homelessness, and we've got Nicola Willis increasing rents for social housing tenants, income-related rents, from 25% to 30%, and saying that they've won the lotto, which she is apparently regrets saying. In terms of poverty, we don't have good statistics on the overall poverty rate, because there's this narrative about the deserving and undeserving poor, so we only look at child poverty. But we can safely say that poverty is increasing, because child poverty has risen 3 years in a row. And there's been a number of sanctions and ways that the government is punishing unemployed people while unemployment increases, that have pushed poverty up.
And you mentioned it at the start there, but with this budget, the government have moved to raise the rent for social housing. For those already in, well, for both those already in social housing and those who may need it, what sort of impact is this raising of rent likely to have?
Well, I suspect it's people teetering on the brink who now have to pay, I think $37 was the quoted figure. As our coordinator, Agnes, said when she spoke to the news, you know, that's a family that has to skip another meal or can't afford to put petrol in the car, because for people living in social housing paying income-related rents, $37 is a lot of money. And for people seeking it, you know, the government's selling off social housing, so the waiting lists are incredibly long, and it's just makes it even more unaffordable housing for everyone who's locked out of the housing market.
The government, I mean, again, you've mentioned it there with the selling off of social housing, but also looking at other policies from this government or the other changes around welfare and poverty that they made in this budget. Is there any kind of light in there, or is it all across the board just grim?
It's just grim. One of the really dark changes is that the government has created a modernisation bill that means that AI will be able to make decisions about things like food grants or beneficiaries. When you're speaking to a human, they are accountable for their decision. They have a conscience. If you desperately need an extra food grant and the computer says no, they can look at that and then they can look you in the eye and they can decide you need it, and that comes first, which is consistent with the Social Security Act, which is designed for alleviating hardship. That's in the law. Now we're going to have artificial intelligence with no heart and no soul rejecting people, and there's no way of holding an algorithm accountable for that decision either. So it's bleak. It's bleak.
I mean, this might go without saying, but were these changes kind of expected, looking at the track record of this government in particular with how they've interfaced with these vulnerable communities?
Yes. This is a government that's been very consistent in chasing its goals of cutting taxes for landlords and cutting taxes for tobacco companies, giving out grants to oil and gas and mining companies, while making life harder for the poor and for pretending that there's no money. We're a rich country. We've got low public debt compared to the rest of the world and also compared to the level of household debt. We've got extremely wealthy people. Wealth inequality is going through the roof. The government is pretending that there's no money. That's been very consistently their narrative. It's wrong. And why they're really pushing people into poverty is because it's good for employers. If there's more people competing over fewer jobs, that means wages go down and profits go up. That's an inbuilt mechanism in the capitalist system to drive down wages and drive up profits. And that's the real reason behind this. It's not just because they're cruel, although they clearly are. There are material reasons for this.
Kind of flipping it around then, what is it that you believe we do need to see when it comes to supporting these vulnerable New Zealanders and actually allowing them to flourish?
Well, I think it starts by looking at the top end. It starts by going four billionaires own more wealth than the bottom 1.8 million New Zealanders. The NBR rich list last year, the next one's due for release in a week, showed that the combined wealth of the wealthiest people in the country is above $100 billion for the first time. There is a huge amount of money that we need to tax, and then we can spend on building hundreds of thousands of state houses, building or buying state houses, publicly owned supermarkets like the mayor of New York, Zora Mamdani, is rolling out would be a great way of bringing down food prices. But our central demands as Auckland Action Against Poverty are livable incomes for everyone and an end to sanctions, because you can't end poverty without simply giving people more money and tackling those costs in housing, in food, in fuel. So that's what we need to see, and we're not going to get it from this government. I don't want people to lose hope when looking at the bleak state of the country and the world. If we organise, if we stand together, we can win a better, fairer future for everyone. That's what our ancestors did in the 1930s. We fought back and we got a welfare state and we got the 1938 Social Security Act, which still says its primary purpose is to alleviate hardship. If you look at New York, they've got Zora Mamdani. He's taxing the rich. He's doing things about poverty. If we organize in our communities, if students get organized, if beneficiaries get organized, if workers get organized, we can fight back. We can get rid of this government, and we can get a government that will genuinely fight for people. That starts with attacking wealth inequality in order to bring that wealth back into our communities.
That was AAAP, Auckland Action Against Poverty's Elliot Crossan, on the 2026 budget changes to social housing and how it will affect those in poverty, amongst other welfare changes.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
A new report from the UN University Institute for Water, Environment and Health has outlined the consequences of AI on water, land and carbon emissions. I spoke to Professor Te Kaka Keegan from the University of Waikato, Department of Software Engineering and co-director of the AI Institute, about the report and the cultural impacts of AI for Māori. I started by asking if he could outline the key findings of the report.
Some of the key findings in the report are that the impact of AI is significant on the environment, basically. It used to be that when you're creating AI models, it took a lot of computing power, and it used to be that that was the main impact, that actually computing, the computer power needed to build the models. But from looking at the report, it's become clear that it's not just the building of the models, but it's the running of the models as well. So this is called inference, and like from a technical perspective, it doesn't take up much energy. But what happens is when thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people are doing it like simultaneously, that's when the computing brain is. So it's the amount of people that are using AI so much that it's starting to become a drain. And that drain is mostly noticed in not so much data centers themselves, but hyper data centers. And the difference between a data center and a hyper data center is basically a data center is like storage, but a hyper data center is where it's the storage of the CPUs. It's where the CPUs are doing all of the compute. And that's what's draining all the energy. The report highlights the difference between a data center and a hyper data center is like about 1,000-fold. The one hyper data center is draining as much energy as 1,000 general data centers. So that's the first and perhaps the most important point of the report is that the uptake and use of AI is having a significant impact on the environment. So that was the first take I took. The second take that I took, and it kind of surprised me a little bit, was that they have a bunch of tables and a bunch of graphs showing which countries the environmental impact is felt the most. And New Zealand doesn't appear on any of those graphs. And the reason it doesn't appear is obviously because we don't have so many hypercentres located here in New Zealand. So the environmental impact in New Zealand by AI at the moment isn't very significant. But it does serve as a bit of a warning that these things are on the way. And when we're looking at building hyper data centres in New Zealand, we really need to consider the impact that they're going to have on the environment, in terms of water, on our power drainage, and then our connections through to the internet as well.
Obviously, the environmental impact of AI, as outlined in this report, is significant. But in the specific context of Aotearoa, there's also cultural considerations. What are your concerns surrounding the cultural impact of AI as well?
Well, that's the very point as well. Here in Aotearoa, Māori have a higher concern, shall we say, for the environment. The Māori perspective of the environment is a lot more heightened than non-Māori, simply because we have a connection to the environment. It's an ancestor. It's a relation. And so we do our best to look after and protect our ancestors and our relations. So any impact that we're having to the environment is higher from a Māori perspective. Then we have some pretty good frameworks. We have some pretty good frameworks to look after our environment. So we have some data governance principles that are set to look after data, but they can also be reapplied to environments. And they can be reapplied because, you know, the priority is sustainability, protection, caring for our environment. So when we see these kinds of impacts happening internationally, from a Māori perspective, we're even more alarmed and we're even more concerned, because we really do strive to protect our environment. You know, if we look after our environment will look after us. So, yeah, I think it's more important here in Aotearoa that we protect our environment, and it's definitely more important from a Māori perspective.
Given these concerns, is it appropriate for Aotearoa to then be building more data centres?
Data centres themselves are okay in certain environments, providing that we're totally aware of all of the ramifications and all of the implications. But hyper data centres are another concern at all. And there's a bunch of things we need to be aware of when it comes to building hyper data centres. So some of the things like we need to be aware of is, what is the complete economic impact? What is the complete environmental impact? What is the sovereignty impact? So there's a bunch of things that we need to be aware of, we need to consider before we can agree to build the larger hyper data centres in Aotearoa.
And on this thread, what are some of these solutions to address the environmental and cultural concerns when it comes to not just data centres, but the use of AI as a whole?
In terms of addressing the issues, the best way to address the issues is to work collaboratively. Work collaboratively with the communities, work collaboratively with Māori. And I think from a Māori perspective, we need to be completely aware, what is the water intake? What is the power intake? How many carbon emissions are going to be occurring? What kind of noise pollution is going to be happening? When is the most strange? So there's a whole lot of parameters that need to be considered, but they should be considered in consultation. They should be considered in consultation with local communities. They should be considered in consultation with Māori, because it's the local communities and it's the Māori that have to live with these structures like forever. So the solution is full and proper consultation and full disclosure of everything that's going to be built, everything that's going to occur, those kind of things.
There's been calls for more localised AI solutions, for example, local storage solutions, as opposed to being dependent on the United States or China or these big AI centres. Is this something you've given much thought to?
That's a great comment. This is something I give thought to every day. You're completely right. There is calls for local solutions for building AI. So that's sovereign AI. Because at the moment, the control of all the AI happens offshore. And so the more we use AI that's controlled offshore, the less independent we become. So we definitely have to be building our own sovereign AI so that we can control the systems that we're using. That's the first thing. The second thing, of course, is local storage solutions. And as Māori, we've been working on that quite a bit recently. So Te Kawiraranga last week announced Te Pātū Watawata. So Te Pātū Watawata is a Māori storage solution where all of the data storage is occurring under Māori, or like on Māori lands, on Māori servers under Māori control. So storage within Te Pātū Watawata cannot be accessed by external entities, cannot be accessed by the US government, going to be accessed by the New Zealand government. So local storage solution that is sovereign, that is controlled locally, but most important is secured locally. Definitely we need to be building sovereign solutions. We have the capability here in Aotearoa to be doing that, and that's a solution for all of the things that this report has identified. Let's build it ourselves, let's own it ourselves, let's control it ourselves, let's protect it ourselves.
I also spoke to Professor Nirmal Nair from the University of Auckland Faculty of Engineering about how the report applies to a local context. I started by asking about his key takeaways from the report.
Well, this particular report is from a UN body, right? And the way I see it, it's just speculating on potential secondary and tertiary impacts, right? Particularly across countries. They've identified 20 countries which are building up data center infrastructure. And New Zealand is not one of them listed there yet, right? So it just talks about secondary and tertiary impacts, right? Because I come from electrical, computer, and software engineering department. So this AI is just built on those stacks there, right? So, yeah, so my initial take on that is it's just trying to correlate with the electricity side of the business, because AI infrastructure is powered by electricity, right? So, and it's looking at those 20 countries and where do they get their electricity from and things like that, right? And then they look at the other aspects about that particular infrastructure which is being built in those countries. So this is just for us as a bellwether for New Zealand to watch out, you know, if we were to embark on, you know, AI data center infrastructure here in Aotearoa.
As you said, New Zealand is not included in the report, but what relevance do you think it has to here?
It depends whether we just want to be technology takers. We are at the bottom of the globe, and do we really want to be part of this emerging, fast emerging technologies of AI, right? So currently in New Zealand, we have electricity, of course, right? We're the oldest in the Southern Hemisphere. We electrified the first place in Reefton when we were, you know, digging gold 140 years ago. We got caught up with the world for computers as well and for software as well so far. But the software space, I think it got kind of merged up with who are providing those software services, and that became global, right? So this AI would follow on a similar lines. So New Zealand will be definitely, you know, we will be connected for AI services, but do we want to be part of this development cycle of using AI, which is showed up within our, you know, our country?
You've discussed how we need to have a wider conversation about the costs and benefits of AI here, but in practical terms, what would this conversation look like and who needs to be involved?
I have been here for quite a long time, and I think the two common pieces I responded, I think once it was when ChatGPT was released in 2024, and then quite recently there was an investment decision about a Southland data center, you know, plans to build a data center. The public mood is being really cautious, and we are not spoken about, you know, if you don't build a data center as an infrastructure, what are the pluses and minuses? So I think we need to have an honest conversation with engineers and things like that, which we built. And we have to go back to our history of, you know, building one of the biggest electricity generation plant in Manapouri, a dam where we didn't even have a load. So what did we choose? We went the Norwegian way. We went to, you know, smelt aluminium, for example, right? That's a large load. And if you actually look at electricity load, the largest electricity consumption is for smelting, you know, bauxite to aluminium. So we don't need to get scared by other countries about, you know, the fragility of our electricity system or something like that. So sometimes we miss the conversation a little bit. And I think we need to have an honest conversation about electricity first, and also about energy, right? So these are two different things, carbon-based energy. And I think this might be the right time for us to kind of talk that through. And on top of it, I think AI part, that's just a developmental cycle associated with it, right? So I think we need to have an honest conversation about addressing complex technical issues and what its impacts and secondary impacts are. So I think that's what I was trying to talk about. And we can't have a kind of a political football, right? Electricity, and then, you know, we mix things issues up, right? So I think we need to have an honest conversation about, yeah, electricity system is pretty secure. It's resilient. I'm absolutely confident about that. But only 30% of our energy comes from electricity, right? So the other 70 is from carbon-based fuels and things like that. And AI is much more around how we use, how we are digitally connected. And we have been using it for 30 years, right? And the very fact that we are communicating through digital means right now is a simple example of it. And even during our pandemic years, right? So we know how to live with it and how to keep us safe. So I think in these issues, we need to be careful about jumping on to some new technology. So AI seems to be a big issue, but I think some of the concerns around privacy and forming a moat is real. I agree with that. But if you want to continue with the way we are using these digital resources, the free internet, which we have, as you might have seen, the free internet has led to misinformation and things like that, challenges and how to use it. But AI would kind of decouple that. It might come out as a totally different infrastructure on top of it, right? So I think we need to have, we need to educate people about the opportunities of AI along with the fears of AI. So that's what I was trying to talk about. And we need to understand what the primary impacts are to those 20 countries. If you have a look at those 20 countries, apart from four countries, which is Canada, France, Sweden, and Switzerland, all the other countries are 90% or more. The electricity system is carbon-based, right? Even Australia is in that list. That's simply because they are not coupling their buildup of their AI infrastructure for training and service needs with electricity, right? So I think I don't know what the social license to those places are. I would have thought in New Zealand it would be pretty easy for us to communicate. That's where I was trying to talk about having an honest conversation.
What do you think about the way the government is currently embracing AI, generative AI, and I'm thinking particularly in the public service?
I don't think it has become widespread. That's just my gut feel. I'm not in the government. But one of the aspects, the workings of the government, let us put it that way, in the last 30, 40 years has been highly digitalized, right? We rely a lot on communicating with our government, interacting with our government, and so on. So the bureaucracies, the policies, the interaction has been through this digital infrastructure. But we fail to forget, we kind of forget blissfully that it is through this free internet, right, which was actually a national defense project in the U.S., the ARPA-E, 1970. So we got used to it, just like electricity, we got used to, those digital services. But what has led in the last 20, 30 years is there's a lot of digital, job growth, process growth, things like that. And our service economy has really boomed. And if you can look at the new jobs right now, it's much more, heavily reliant on digital. So I think the government is trying to weigh those fears of job losses, things like that, and reshaping itself and resizing itself, or maybe, kind of arming itself, or all its employees and things like that, and politicians as well, with that AI knowledge, right? And I think the conversation seems okay. And in our MMP political cycle, right, I think some of the aspects of job losses which are being talked about might really not be because of AI, but just because of the way things are structured. So these conversations I'm hearing from public media, but I'm not really privy to, the government workings. So, but I'm optimistic, right? At least our voices do carry forward, and we are a small community of 5 million people.
That was Professor Te Kaka Keegan from the University of Waikato and Professor Nirmal Nair from the University of Auckland on a new UN University report on the environmental impacts of AI.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council Shane Henderson, University of Auckland's Dr Lisa Dara, Auckland Action Against Poverty's Elliot Crossan, University of Waikato's Te Kaka Keegan, and University of Auckland's Nirmal Nair, you're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Takata Punani.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.